This is Countryfile Live 2019, the podcast that lets you relive some of the best moments from the talks and presentations that happened in the National Trust Theatre at this year's BBC Countryfile Live event at Blenheim Palace. In this series, you'll hear from the likes of J.B. Gill on his transition from fame to farming, and from our panel of expert gardeners who deal with all your gardening dilemmas. And from Timothy Bentinck, a.k.a. David Archer, who gives us a peek behind the scenes of the Archers. In this episode, we join Countryfile presenter Charlotte Smith in conversation with Ray Mears, who discuss when's the best time to get involved with nature, what witchetty grubs really taste like, and why he's against saving the planet.
Where have you been? What have you been up to this year?
I've been doing a lot of teaching this year. I'm celebrating... Well, last year, we celebrated 35 years of teaching bushcraft. And I turned to my team and I said, what should we do to celebrate? And they said, we want you to run the courses that you haven't run for 20 years. So that's been a shock for all of us. I think mostly for them.
Did you have to do some revision? Fun. Did you have to sort of think, what was I teaching 20 years ago?
No, it's been really good fun, actually. I've really enjoyed it. And it's lovely working one-on-one with people. There's nothing better than that.
So who mainly have you been teaching?
Well, it's just a cross-section of society. People come from all walks of life, all backgrounds, interests. That's the fun of it. You spend time around a campfire with other people's life experiences. Yeah, I love that. Television's just one way. Campfires, it works both ways, so it's good.
Do you learn as well as teach?
All the time. Never stop. One lifetime is not enough. I'm always learning. I read 4 books at once, and I'm irritated that life isn't longer, because there are questions I won't get to the bottom of that I'd really like to. Yeah.
So you've been doing this 35 years. Are you, or if you're honest, still as enthusiastic about it?
Yeah, more so. More so. Yeah. I'm very lucky. I have the best job in the world. So I love what I do. I'm still discovering things about the plants and the trees here in Britain, as well as other parts of the world, that have surprised me. You know, sometimes I without going into the details, but there was a plant 2 years ago that I discovered had a use, that I've been friends with that plant for 30 or 35 years, and I didn't know. And then one day I worked out that there was something else you could do with it, and it's like, duh, it's been there in front of me all that time, and It's such exciting work, and everything you learn transforms the way you see the world around you. You see the countryside in a new way, and so what isn't to like,
So you are capable of still being surprised?
All the time, yeah. Nature is surprising, and I'm also excited because there are amazing researchers around the world doing incredible research in nature. But when I started, if you wanted to find out about research, you had to find the books. And, these small minor publications on natural history were expensive. But now this information is available through the power of the internet. And so we can share that learning. And, as a species, we are learning at an exponential rate. So it's exciting to be able to surf that wave, yeah.
You have been talking about this, as you say, for more than 3 decades. Are you frustrated that actually there are a lot of people who are still not listening, really, who are still slightly closed to the natural world?
I'm amazed at how many people still can't recognise common flowers, common plants, the things around them. And that's not this audience, because that's the great thing about walking around the show. Everybody has a love of nature. But there are an awful lot of people out there who still, they can't tell a daisy from a dandelion. And that worries me, because we're handing the future to the next generation, but we are not equipping them with the tools to read the environment and to recognise the impact of what we do. And yet we're making demands on them to take care of it and improve things. So that seems a little unfair to me.
Should we formally teach it more than we do in school?
Yes, I think we should. But not in a formal sense. I mean, I think the learning about nature should be wonder. And when I started teaching 36 years ago, if I remember the people who were my age then, they knew more about the countryside than people of the same age today. And the reason was they didn't study nature as part of biology. They used to do something at school called nature study. And that was fun. It was a lesson they all looked forward to.
I'm going to use a phrase now that I know you're not terribly keen on, but it's something we were talking about in our last session with both younger and older activists, and that's saving the planet. What's wrong with that as an expression?
Oh, I can't stand that phrase. I'm going to sound really old and fuddy-duddy now, but you know, you go into a shop and you ask for a loaf of bread and there'll be somebody serving you, probably with their hair over one eye, and they say, do you want a bag? And they say, no. Oh, good, you're saving the planet. I'm not saving the planet. The planet is not a threat. And that's important to understand. This planet will rock on quite happily without us, just as it does without the dinosaurs. There's a threat to the environment, and that is from the bottom of the ocean to the top of our atmosphere. This thin film of life, the veneer of life, that's on our planet. And that's incredibly precious and very fragile. And we are a key part of that. That's what's at threat. We're scared to say we are threatened by our own behavior. But I truly think until we actually confront that truth, we're not going to do anything about it. That's what's at threat, that thin film of life on the surface of our planet. That's what's at threat.
Now, when we were talking earlier with the young people, they felt that if more people their age, they were teenagers, knew, and I'll use the example that they used, which was knew about earwigs from an early age, then we would understand that threat and feel that threat better.
It's quite interesting. What is the value of the threat, in talking about it? The value is to try and make governments and big corporations change the way they think, the way they exploit the money that the ordinary people pay them for their products and so on. But the most important thing isn't the threat. The most important thing is the appreciation. What we have to is not burden the next generation with a sense of guilt for humankind's activities, but to turn them on to the possibilities of how magical the world would be if we increased habitat, if we cleaned up the oceans, if we cleaned up the air. What an incredible place it would be to live and to share their lifetime with all the other wonderful creatures that we could be sharing them with. That's what's exciting to me. So, you know, I'm not a doom monger. You know, I'm quite happy to let others kick the donkey up the backside. I want to present greener grass. Because actually, I think that's the quickest way to get a donkey to move.
How would you then enthuse both children and adults alike? Where would you start?
Well, I think a very important thing is to just go outside. I know it sounds so simple, but there are many, many children who are not allowed to play outside because people are scared. Fear is a terrible thing. And I sometimes now meet youngsters in their 20s or even 30s who've just come out from behind their computer games. And they're excited about nature, but there are so many things they can't do that they should have learned when they were 10. And, you know, there are times in your life, the right moment to learn things. There's a right time in your life to learn about a stinging nettle so that you can ignore it later in life. And it's very important that we learn things at the right time in our lives. And I don't think we've been doing a good job of that.
So I'm in my mid-50s. What should I be learning, do you think? Lying down in a darkened room?
Well, I've been practicing how to do everything without the need for reading glasses. So,
fortunately, that's challenging.
Yeah, that's challenging. I started doing that some years ago, so I'm all right. But every age, I don't think, you know, mid-50s is the right time to start climbing. And there's nothing to say you shouldn't.
Thank goodness, because I haven't.
You know, your body isn't designed for it at that point.
I don't think mine ever was, but yes.
I think that you have to, you know, we age and life is very short. And so it's very important to do the right things at the right time in your life.
Okay, a question here.
When you're wandering around the outback feeling hungry, how do you like a witchetty grubs? With butter, with custard, or toasted with jam?
I like the choices.
Well, witchetty grubs I really like. That's something that you should know. I'm quite happy to gather and eat them myself. I like them raw and I like them cooked in the fire. But what I say is if you were to put them in batter and deep fry them, they would be as popular as scampi in the shops. They're quite delicious. But they're an important food for Aboriginal people. And I think that's something that's often forgotten. They're an easily digested source of protein, And so they were more or less reserved for children. Children often malnourished in the desert for a variety of very complex reasons. And so they were important food. And we joke about them in the West, but for Aboriginal people, you know, the Pitjantjatjara call them moku, they're a really critical food source. They're very interesting.
Is there anything you wouldn't eat?
Yeah, Brussels sprouts, I can't stand them.
Actually, I am with you there. Yeah, good decision.
Any farmers, sorry.
No, they're just horrible. Tell us who you are, sir.
Hello, Vince Johnson. Nice to see you here. But what would you help an 11-year-old child with? What would be the first thing you would give them? Say a compass or something like that?
It depends on the child. I think children, you need to provide them with the opportunity to find their own inspiration and then just support it. So if there may be something you're not interested in, it might be an animal tracker, it might be an insect, but don't force anything on them. Let them find their interest and then help them to it. And they may go down that road for a while and then abandon it and go somewhere else. It doesn't matter, because in exploring that interest, their brain develops, their mind, their intellect, their inquisitiveness and their self-confidence grows. And that's the key thing.
Hi, my name's Mandy Windsor. I work in a school in Stafford, and we have, right from reception children up to year 11, something called forest schools, where they go out, we have an area, and they learn about the outdoors, they make fires, they use, we have knives for them that they use. So in certain schools now, and certain authorities, they are letting children go out and do this right from the very early age.
I think it's fantastic. I would like to see them have a higher input of technical knowledge at forest school. And one of the things that I get frustrated by is I see dens being built. What is a den? A den is a badly made shelter. And my experience of children is they will build the thing properly the first time because they are just overflowing with enthusiasm and excitement. And the reason these things don't get built properly is because the adults haven't the patience to see the process through. And what we need to do is the opposite, is to encourage that enthusiasm and build it and learn from the children. So, yeah. But I agree. I think it's great that we allow children out to learn. But it doesn't just have to be about learning to make shelters and fires. You know, equally, you can take English literature out under an oak tree and read it there. And I think that's a wonderfully stimulating place. The senses are stimulated. The learning is enhanced.
Yeah, and it's hugely fun, isn't it?
And
I mean, it's
fun.
Hugely
yeah.
fun. Gentleman in the hat.
Hello. If you were just starting out in bushcraft, like, what would you recommend your kind of key skills to learn, first of all?
You have to first learn the survival skills to be safe outdoors. And everyone wants to do all the exciting things, the fire and so on. You start by understanding the physiology of a human being and how you can die if you get too cold. And you build from there. And I worry that people I meet who've started on this road on their own have gone to YouTube to learn, which is very dangerous. And they haven't got the proper foundation, you know. And the key thing in learning outdoor skills is they must be progressive. You know, don't say I'm in 2 weeks practice, now I'm going to go off into the middle of nowhere. You must do progressive challenges and grow. And that's also why we should start young. It's much easier to start young and as you grow, so your challenges grow with you. For me, at this stage of my life, the rainforest is like the nettle patch that was at the end of the garden when I was six. And that's where you want to get to, but you have to take that journey slowly. Don't try to be an expert. Enjoy being a student. That's really important.
Hello, Ray. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you think, I've bitten off more than I can chew here?
Yeah, probably today. No, not really. No. There have been situations that are challenging or threatening, but when you deal with them, you have to focus on the training that you've got, your experience, and just dealing with the issue. Focus is really important. If something's going wrong and you haven't the ability to focus and concentrate, then you're a great threat. But the moment you focus, the fear and all of the negative things that can get in the way are pushed to one side and you get the job done. Afterwards, you can reflect on things and think, but no, I've been pretty lucky in that regard. Yeah.
Is that partly because of the preparation that's actually we've been talking about started when you were tiny?
Yeah. It's this learning process. If you want to learn bushcraft or the outdoor skills of that nature, you have to be committed to lifelong learning. And that's not just about learning the skills, it's also learning how to pass them on and how to work in a group of people. So I'll give you an example. If I'm working with people and I think somebody is becoming hypothermic, I don't say to them, I think you're getting cold, Charlotte, we better have a stop and have a drink, because I'll get a hostile reaction. You go, no, I'm fine, shut up. So what I would say is, I'm cold, do you mind if we stop and have a hot drink? So you have to learn to be subtle and clever and how you use your knowledge to achieve your end. So it's the kind of learning that's involved.
Question over here.
Where's one of the places you've had a most interesting night's sleep on your adventures?
The most interesting night's sleep? I remember once sleeping in Honduras in terrible weather in a hammock in the jungle, and all of us were sleeping in hammocks. We'd created walkways between them with palm fronds because it was so wet. And we all went to sleep early because it was raining. And then about 3 hours later, there was this sound of a tidal wave getting closer and closer and closer. And then I'm thinking, it can't be. I'm on top of a mountain. I'm nowhere near the sea. And this tidal wave was just... And then everybody was awake because it really sounded like there was a wave coming towards us. And then it just stopped. And the next morning, about an hour down the trail, there was a huge tree in the rainforest had fallen over, and that sound had been all the breaking vines as it came down, and that's what that sound was. So that was a very strange night.
Who or what do you think would have the biggest influence on you?
That's very difficult. I'm very interested in the lives of some of the 18th century explorers, and many of those have opened my eyes to a whole range of possibilities. They did so much in an age when there was no aircraft travel. There was a very important book when I was about 14, maybe slightly younger than that. I was playing in the library at school, horse playing with my friends, and the teacher came. We all grabbed desks and sat down and pretended to be reading books. And I found this book in front of me, turned it the right way up, and it was a book called The Forest People by Colin Turnbull, who was an anthropologist who spent a year in the Ituri rainforest with the Bambuti pygmy. And I missed the next two lessons. And the next year, I was 15, I booked on a seminar at the Royal Geographical Society for postgraduates, planning how to plan an expedition to a tropical rainforest. So I was the youngest member by 10 years. And I think that book had a very profound influence on me, yeah.
A lot of us have problems in reconciling the carbon footprint when we fly away on holiday. How do you do that when you fly on your trips?
I think the first thing is, I understand where you're coming from. I don't think feeling guilty about things is going to help. And I worry the next generation are being burdened with a sense of guilt. When you travel, you see the full extent of what's going on in other parts of the world. I think it's really important that we travel. And my reason for that is that no matter how willing all of us in this room are to stop buying plastic bags and to think about sourcing our food locally, we are but a drop in the global ocean. And it's an important drop, and we have to start here. But it's very important to understand the scale of the problem. We have to learn as a species, not as a nation, to work together. And that will only happen by communication, by talking to each other. We live in a strangest time. There is more prejudice creeping into the world than I've seen in my lifetime. And that seriously worries me. Until we can actually stop butting heads together and work together, we don't see much future. So I think the importance of travel is vitally important. Because when you travel, particularly if you travel alone to a strange country, you're forced to communicate with other cultures and nations, and you learn thereby to respect each other.
Is there anywhere left that you would like to travel to?
Oh, yeah, lots of places, yes, yeah. It's a very big planet. And
Where haven't you been?
There are lots of places I haven't been, yeah. And yeah, I've got lots of interest, but I keep them close to my chest.
Ooh. Hi, it's Christina. When you're carrying out bushcraft, if you have never encountered a plant or a bug before, how do you know if it's safe to eat?
I don't. It's as simple as that. I don't use any of the tests that you might read about. And gosh, 1995, I went to a conference, a military conference on survival. They had all the world survival scores. And I asked them, do you have an edibility test that you teach on your courses? And I collected all of those tests together. And there were, I think, 17 different tests being taught around the world. These are means where you rub it or you put it on your lip to see if it's edible. There's no agreement. If you don't know, you can't be certain. And the only safe way is to know whether something's edible. That's it in a nutshell. The only time that an edibility test might be useful is for a soldier. If you've been captured in a jungle somewhere and you're being kept in a bamboo cage and you've got no other source of food, then perhaps under those circumstances an edibility test would be of some use. But which one to use is a whole different question.
It's just not worth taking the risk, is it? I mean, as a natural-born coward.
Yeah, and there are some foods that have been used by native people that we know today are not edible. Even if they're processed, they can't actually remove the toxins. It's a really interesting subject, but it's complicated.
My glamorous assistant is making signs from the back of the tent to say that, sadly, that is all we have time for. I'm so sorry. Ray Mears.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this extract from the many talks and debates that happened in the National Trust Theatre at BBC Countryfile Live 2019. To learn more about this and other audio programmes from the National Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. And to purchase your ticket for BBC Countryfile Live 2020, go to countryfilelive.com. This is a National Trust podcast recorded at BBC Countryfile Live 2019.